Good afternoon, and thank you for coming. Also, thanks for inviting me here. So this is work that I'm doing together with Tobias Fritz, that you probably all know. And it's about information decomposition. So what does this really mean? So supposedly we have a system consisting of many parts. I don't know, for example, many particles possibly interacting. And supposedly this system is encoding some information. So it has some information content. The question is, how is this divided between the parts? Or even actually, if this is actually divided between the parts, or what happens in this case? So some places where these kind of questions show up are, for example, statistics. So we all know that, for example, a correlation between two random variables is encoding some kind of common information between the two. There's something in common there. If there are three or more, this is less clear, especially if they are nonlinear, so we don't have just some common source for all of them. Or another place where this shows up is game theory, where, we have some players that may some have partial information, and this shows up in different ways in their strategies. Another place where this shows up is biology. Actually, this is the, so to say, the king application of this, because in all these kind of complex networks, or even in artificial intelligence, the interesting part is exactly the interaction. So to say that one neuron singularly does not think, not even two, and especially they don't do it separately. So the, so to say the interesting part is exactly the way how they interact. So in all these examples, the underlying principle is one that's, so to say, with the words of Aristotle, we could say that the whole is more than the sum of the parts, okay? This is, of course, an idea that's been around for millennia, but mathematically it has never been made so precise, until at least information theory. So how do we make this mathematically precise? Well, Shannon tells us that we can view information mathematically as somehow the content that is in a message that we still have not read, but about which you still have some expectation. So in the simplest case, suppose that you have a coin that you can flip. You can actually get heads or tails, or 0 and 1 if you like computers more. Now, the thing is, like, it's a 50-50 situation. When you read the message, or when you throw the coin, so you know the outcome, you're a little surprised. How much surprised? Well, 1 bit. If you flip 2 coins, well, you will have 2 bits of information. And the entropy in this case is simply the entropy of the joint random variable. So you do the same thing on x and y. In case we have more than one random variable, we can also look at conditional entropy, which is kind of the entropic analog of conditional probability. So what does this mean? This is the randomness of x, so to say, if we already know y. In this case, you see that it's still a 50-50 kind of situation. So the total entropy here will be 1 bit. But you also see that if we know x, if we know y, for example, we know that we are here, x is deterministic. X will be this one. So there's no randomness of x given y. But of course, the total entropy here is non-zero. And we can say the same thing about the other way around in this case. Now, what does it mean that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts? Well, there are a number of inequalities that we can draw between these entropies, which are called Shannon-type inequalities. Now, for example, we know that the joint entropy is always less than the sum of the two entropies. What does this mean? Well, the standard interpretation is that in this sum, we have counted something twice. So this is the picture. So x has some randomness, some information. Y also does. And the joint amount of information is not just a sum, because something actually is common information between x and y. In the same way, if we look at conditional probabilities, so that we just look at the information content that x has, if y is known, so x has no more information that y also carries, then the sum of the conditionals is less than the joint. And actually, the difference between these two quantities is the same as above, up to a sign. So that means that the marginal entropies can be drawn as these parts here, and the area in the middle is exactly this common thing. So the area in the middle, because of these inequalities, is always positive quantity, which is called mutual information, and it's usually denoted with these semicolons is just standard notation. And this is somehow the information that these two random variables have in common. So it kind of generalizes the idea of correlation. So in the example that we saw before, remember we were saying that here it's a 50-50 situation. So we have one bit of joint entropy. So here you can see also that x is 50-50, and y is also 50-50, all right? So entropy of x is 1, entropy of y is 1, entropy of x and y is 1. So you see, they are not equal, and their difference is 1. So there's one bit of mutual information. We can see this kind of one bit of correlation, so to say. And you can do the same reasoning with conditional entropies. Now, so the underlying idea here is that somehow statistical interaction, so this correlation between different things, work like intersection of sets. So there's some information in common, and you can really draw it this way. People actually even somehow motivate these information theoretic inequalities by drawing Venn diagrams, so diagrams of sets and overlaps. And this is kind of some kind of guiding principle. Now, what happens if we do it with three random variables? Well, we can still, of course, forget about Z and look at just the mutual information between X and Y, like before. Or now we can do the same thing at given Z, so just taking this slice of the intersection. And by subtracting these two terms, we get to this middle region, which is denoted by this double semicolon, and it's called interaction information, that should encode somehow the three-wise correlation between x, y, and z. So if you remember the example above with x and y correlated, imagine them this time on a diagonal in three dimension. Now, what's the problem with this quantity or this picture? Well, that it's not true anymore, that this quantity is always positive. So what does this really mean? It means that this quantity is not always less than this quantity. So we had drawn this as if, you know, this region being a part of this whole region. But actually, if we don't have this inequality, this this interpretation in terms of sets does not work very well, because it's not true that this region is smaller than the whole thing. So an example where this happens is the so-called situation with synergy. What's synergy? Synergy is whenever, if you condition on one variable, you increase the correlation of the remaining variable. So you see, in this case, for example, the solid blocks are probability which are non-zero, and the white ones are probabilities of zero. So this is a kind of an extra gate. So x is 1 if y equals z, and 0 otherwise. You see, if you see this from above, so this looks like a uniform probability. So this tells us that there's no interaction marginally between x and y. But instead, if we condition on z, so for example, we pick the top floor here, you see that there's perfect correlation between x and y. So the conditional mutual information is 1 bit, like before, but the marginal is 0. So you see, conditioning on z increases the correlation, so synergy situation. And this violates this inequality. So basically, it makes that drawing somehow fail. Now, one would say, well, OK, pick everything with the opposite sign. No, that doesn't work either. Because, so here's not so clear, but this block here is one floor above again. I hope it's visible. So here you see that in this case, x equals y equals z. They are perfectly correlated. And so if we look at it from above again, this looks like perfect correlation between x and y. But you also see that given z, for example, again, picking the top floor, we have like 1, 0, 0, 0, which is a product probability measure. So zero interaction. So here in this case, we have that conditioning decreases the correlation. This is usually called redundancy in the literature, actually. If you're interested in this synergy and redundancy thing, you can look in these two papers that explain this quite well, and also what they mean in applications to neuroscience. So in general, this will not be larger than this, and not smaller.
Do you have the expression for the mutual between x, y, z, the two colons, in terms of the conditional one and the marginal one, just because I don't know the definition? So you're telling me that something's positive, but you haven't told me what the definition of that thing is.
Ah, sorry, yes.
Maybe on the blackboard, because I don't think it's on your slide.
Yes, so. Actually, I don't know the official definition, but the idea is that the difference between these two terms, mutual information, is the difference between these two terms. So plus h of y minus h of x and y, minus h of x, okay? It's exactly what made that quantum. Now, if you do the same thing with conditional probabilities, this is visible, you get a new quantity. This is also always positive. Mm-hmm. Okay? The problem is that it's not true that this is larger than this or smaller. So these two are somehow unrelated.
So the thing I was looking for a definition for was your I x colon y colon z.
So this is called interaction information. This is defined as the difference between this and this. Actually, it depends on the conventions, so somehow, sometimes the other way around. Okay. So I write it like this. So this is y of xz minus, xy, minus y of xy given z. Okay. So the motivation, if you want, is that the whole intersection was the mutual information, right? Mm-hmm. So just this part, so excluding that was this one, and so this one should be somehow their difference.
Okay,
but this makes sense, like this is the area of this part, just if it's positive, otherwise it would be some kind of negative area.
So your first example of the two examples you gave made it negative, and the second example.
Yeah, so in this case you see these inequalities do not hold. Okay? But we can also not do the opposite because of this example. So,
I see. So you're saying if you just reverse the sign, it would still
No.
If you reverse the sign, it wouldn't fit your set theoretic picture either.
No, but you have to draw another picture if you want. I can show you later. But that doesn't work either because of this basically. This is a problem. The question is, can we draw? So is there a way, how do we draw this, basically? Is there a way in which we can draw it for three variables? Because the way we did now didn't work. So it does not respect these inequalities. Okay? So let's make this set theoretical analogy, first of all, a little more precise. So we want to say that there's an inequality each time there is an inclusion here, somehow. So an information theoretical inequality each time we include something in a larger set, just like for area, basically. So what we're saying is that suppose we have a large set U, like, I don't know, this screen. We draw some sets in here, and we also want to take their unions and intersection, right? So we have a set U, we write X, we write Y, and now X and Y are not one larger than the other in general, but they are both smaller than their union. So imagine this arrow as being contained of or being smaller than, and both contain the intersection. Just as well, we can take the whole thing, which contains everything, and the empty set that is contained in everything in a trivial way. Now, we call this a lattice of sets whenever these join and meet. So these upper bound and lower bound, I would call them join and meet, are actually the unions and intersection. Actually, okay, technically I want to take their areas of those drawings, so, well, they have to have a measure. But so the idea is that they are sets that have a well-defined notion of area, basically. Now, what's the idea? Is that if we go up here, we go into a larger set. What does it mean, larger? So with a larger area, okay? So the measure will be a monotone function on our lattice. So we'll increase as we go up in the lattice. More precisely, so just imagine R with its usual order, so going up. We are saying that if we go up here on the left, we go also up here on the right. So somehow the order is reflected here, is preserved. Now, of course, X and Y are mapped like this. We could also map them the other way around. Doesn't matter, because these are not compared here. So there's no relation between these two. What we want is that both are, of course, lower or equal than their join or union, and larger or equal than their meet or intersection. Okay? So before we were able to do this, the set theoretical picture for information, because we had some Shannon type inequalities. For example, entropy of X is always lower than the joint entropy. which if you look at them, they actually are the arrows here on the left, okay? Entropy of X and entropy of Y are usually not one larger than the other, so that's why arrow. But for example, the mutual information is always smaller than both. So somehow we are able to encode the inequalities with a diagram like this that could have been seen as arising from inclusions of sets. Okay? So this was exactly what we were not able to do in the three variable case. So that's, we didn't have the right inequalities to talk about the inclusions. Something was failing. Also, if you look at this, this looks really appealing because we are saying that X and Y have different types of information. Okay? So the union does not just contain quantitatively more information than those. It contains actually this information of X plus some other, all right? So X and Y may have different amounts of information, but these informations are like apple and oranges. The union contains actually both, and the intersection is actually what they have in common, right? But X and Y are not compared directly, and this is kind of very, so to say, it's kind of answering to what kind of information is this in some way. And we should be able to do this also for three variables. So we still want to say that, for example, the joint variable has more information than just one marginal and so on. So let's see if we can at least draw a diagram like this. So we're asking if information in general forms a lattice, so has a lattice structure. And I repeat, a lattice is partially ordered, so somehow keeps track also not just of how much information, but also what information. So let's make this a little more precise. Take an observable y. We want to say that this is more informative than an observable x. It makes us distinguish more between possible states, okay? Somehow makes us be more able to decide. So if we draw this, suppose we have some space of possible outcomes with some samples, which are, if you want, our experimental data, which are drawn as these black dots. Now, what's an observable? An observable is a partition of this thing in four, let's say, macro states, okay? Now, we want to say that a new observable y is more informative if it has more divisions, including the old one. So it has to contain all the divisions of x and possibly add some new ones, right? So mathematically, it has to induce a finer partition. Okay, so for example, in this case, you see that they don't refine each other. So y is not more informative than x because it doesn't contain all the division that x has. Well, and so, well, it's just a partial order. Sometimes we won't be able to say which is more informative than which. Now, why do we want to do this? Because we want this not to depend on the data that we've taken, on the sample distribution. So for example, if x is a, I don't know, position of a particle, and y is the position of that particle and the position of another particle, then we want to say that y has more information, and this regardless of the distribution of the data, right? It's an intrinsic thing on the observables. It does not depend on the state. So you see that in this case, if y contains all the divisions of x and adds some more, if we throw in more data, this is still more more informative. So it's stable with respect to variations in the sample space. But instead, if they do not refine each other in that sense, you see here x is more informative than y, but if our state is instead this one, then y is more informative than x. So these cannot be compared intrinsically, okay? We could give a number to their, I don't know, entropy, which depends on the state, but that would not satisfy inequalities that hold for every state. This thing would depend on the state. So the only stable thing is a partial order. And we will denote it by this larger or equal. That is a partial order. So even if I write larger or equal, these are not real numbers, okay? Now, can we make a lattice out of this? Yes. So we take, for example, these two random variables, two observables with their partitions. We can form their join partition, which is basically taking the union of all these lines. So the finest part, so the finer partition of both, we divide in all these regions, or we can take the meat partition, so which is some kind of intersection, which is just the lines that both have, and this is less informative than both. Okay, and then like before, we can take, well, the discrete partition, so we basically each point is isolated, and the zero partition, which has no division, so no divisions basically. This is a lattice, and it's a sublattice of the lattice of partitions. So partitions form a lattice under refinements, and this will be a sublattice of the partition lattice. Okay, so does this have to do anything with entropy? So let's repeat a second. Entropy does not enter the semantics of information. Entropy tells you how much information, but not which information. This study is kind of finer, right? So this tells us that X, for example, can distinguish between this and this. Y cannot. Y, on the other hand, can distinguish between this and this, and X cannot. So this is, even if it's qualitative, so entropy is quantitative, but it's still some kind of finer because it tells us which informations, which distinctions these two observables make, not just how many distinctions they make. So how can we get entropy naturally out of this as a uniform, so a monotone function here, a function that increases if we go up? Well, there are different ways to come up with the same idea. We can come from physics, for example. So entropy as the log number of microstates per macrostate. Or if you know about mixing entropy and, for example, drawing boundaries between your phase space, then you probably will have this familiar. So what's the idea here? We can permute these elements in a way. We can permute the elements in a way that preserves the partition. All right. So this point cannot go up, but for example, we can interchange these two. So each partition comes with an automorphism group. This automorphism group is just a product of the single cell. So it means that basically the automorphism group that respects this partition is the product of all the permutation groups of these cells, right? Now, if we take a coarser partition, so one with less information, with less boundaries, well, now we can do more movements, right? Some things that before we could not do, now we can do them. They are this dotted arrow. I hope you can see that I've drawn them differently. Now, of course, all the arrows that we had before are still there, plus we had some more. So mathematically, if we have a coarser partition, so one with less information, we get a new automorphism group, and our old group will be a subgroup of the new group. Okay? This old group we will contain in this one. Now, careful here, because we are saying that somehow if X is larger in terms of information, its automorphism group is smaller. All right? So there's an order reversing here. But for the rest, well, we can take our trivial partition, our zero partition, the one where everything is freely moving all around. So this will have as an automorphism group simply the whole permutation group of our sample space. And every other partition will have as automorphism group a subgroup of this one, right? So these, so to say, constrained permutations are, of course, included in the total permutations. Now, subgroups of this permutation group form a lattice under inclusions. And so we will have a sublattice of this subgroup lattice. But we have to be careful because, remember, the order is reversed. So what we really have here is that our lattice of information is not isomorphic to a sublattice of the subgroup lattice of the permutation group. It will be isomorphic to a reversed sublattice of the lattice of permutation groups. So it's embedded in here, but flipped upside down. Of course, this complicates things quite a bit, so we don't want it. And we flip it back up. We take the dual lattice to the one of subgroups, which is the lattice of quotients of the group. Now, let's actually say what this is. So take our sample space unconstrained. We allow all partitions. Oh, I didn't draw all the arrows, but imagine all of them. Now, if we do a partition, suddenly some of these transitions are forbidden. We cannot do them anymore. Okay? So what is the quotient space? The quotient space is basically a set of all these forbidden arrows. but counted in this way. So if these two forbidden arrows differ by an allowed one, then they just count for one. So for example, these two, you see these two transitions differ by an allowed transition. So here we are breaking the law just once. And so we count this just for one. Okay, so with these identifications, the set of all these forbidden arrows will be a measure of somehow of how informative X is, because the more boundaries X is putting, the more transitions it is forbidding, okay? So the number of forbidden arrows will be a nice measure of how informative our partition is, okay? So we take the lattice of coefficients. What's going on here? The more informative a partition is, the more divisions it has, okay? So the less allowed transition it has, okay? That's why subgroups were reversing the orders. But instead, the forbidden ones increase in number if we increase the divisions, okay? So we back up to our usual order, and these two lattices look the same, and we don't have to flip anything anymore. In particular, if we take the discrete partition, well, we have to quotient by nothing, because in the discrete partition, nothing can move. And if you take the empty partition, where everyone moves freely, we have to quotient by the whole transitions, and so we get the trivial group here. And in the middle, we will get some other elements. So this notation is a little cumbersome and takes some space, so let me just denote these elements with some this small h, because entropy will come up later from this. So this is really not just a one-to-one correspondence, but it's really a lattice homomorphism. So this element is the image of this, but it's also actually the join of these two, and this is the meat of these two. Okay? And these guys are the, so to say, the sets of these dotted arrows. Now, these elements are sets and these are inclusions, right? So as we've said that as we increase our information, we have more forbidden arrows, okay? So the number of arrows will increase. But this is not a lattice of sets in the definition I gave before. Okay? So these elements here are sets and these are inclusions, but we don't have real unions and intersections. So it's not really a lattice of sets. Because the intersection of subgroups is really a subgroup, but the union of subgroups is not a subgroup. We have to take the subgroup generated by that. So to see why, so this is, take vector spaces, right? If we have two vector spaces, this one and this one, then their intersection is a vector space, all right? But their union, take this one and this one, their union is not a vector space. It's a cross. So we have to take the subspace generated by this, which will be the plane. So you see, it's not the union of sets. It's larger, OK? So the subgroups are the same. So vector spaces are actually special groups. So these are not really union intersections. But anyway, these elements are sets. And the cardinality is a very nice increasing function. So the number of these dotted arrows, right? So to see how informative our partition is, we just take the number of dotted arrows, of forbidden arrows, again, up to the allowed ones, right? Actually, we take the logarithm of that number, because that's standard in entropy. But it's fine, because the logarithm is also an increasing function. So this does not break anything. So what is the cardinality of this quotient space? Well, this is the quotient between the whole permutation group, which is cardinality of E factorial, divided by the product of the cardinalities of the single cells. So this is a multinomial. So people in thermodynamics might recognize this as coarse entropy. So basically, this is like the entropy of a gas before the limit. So all our atoms are still big and finite. We still haven't done any limits here. And this function is really nice because it's monotone. So what does this mean? That the lattice structure, so the arrows in the lattice, will induce some inequalities in these quantities, kind of like the Shannon type inequalities.
Carlo, can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
The cardinality of the quotient space.
Yeah.
You described it as a fraction of the cardinality of the whole group over the cardinality
Yes.
Automorphisms groups within
yeah.
each cell.
So the cardinality of the quotient group is actually the quotient of the cardinalities. This is a theorem.
How does that fit with what you said before concerning the fact that, you know, if I have two dotted arrows between two cells, it's really just one, that's an equivalence class in the quotient space.
Yeah, so these two are in the same equivalence class. So these two arrows just count for one.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. And so what are we doing here again? We want to get to the actual entropy, so we want to make these smaller and more. All right? So we take basically multiples of our samples. Now, what happened to the lattice? Nothing, right? That was the whole point. The lattice is a partial order exactly because we want to make this independent from the distribution of our samples. Okay? So these new quantities, which is the same thing scaled by n, will be again a monotone function of our lattice. Exactly because everything here is stable under variations of the sample space. Now we can use Stirling's approximation. This tells us that the number of total arrows grows factorially, the number of allowed arrows grow factorially, but the number of forbidden arrows, again in this way, grows only, so to say, exponentially. So its logarithm grows linearly. And the rate of this linear asymptotic rate is up to a constant exactly Shannon entropy. So we can recover the Shannon entropy as, now be careful, the rate of exponential growth of these forbidden arrows as we throw in additional samples. Okay? So how informative a partition is, so how much it divides, so to say, how much it distinguishes, is quantified by how fast the prohibited arrows grow as we throw in additional samples. Moreover, this will be again a monotone function on our lattice, which means that this entropy for different observables will satisfy some inequalities that will exactly reflect the ones of the lattice, right? So we will get that entropy of X is always lower than the joints, and so on. So actually, all Shannon types inequalities will be, so to say, some consequences of this information lattice. Somehow, they're encoding this partial order structure between observables. So how much more information they have. And again, the lattice actually says more because it tells you also which information. So this so far works with two. I've drawn it for two, but you can do the same for three. This works in general, right? Of course, the question that remains is if this can be drawn using Venn diagrams, okay? Because with two we were able, with three we were not, at least not in that way. So is the information lattice always isomorphic to a lattice of sets? And now by lattice of sets I mean in the definition with unions and intersections. Well, lattices of sets always have this property. So the intersection distributes over the union. What does this mean? If we take the union of Y and Z and then its intersection with X, or if we take first the intersection between X and Z, and then the intersection between X and Y, and then their union, these will be equal. And this will happen for each lattice of sets, so no matter how complicated, no matter how large. All right? So this means that, first of all, if some lattice does not have this property, it's not a lattice of sets. But there's a theorem that this tells us that this is an if and only if condition, at least in the finite case. So if we want to draw some Venn diagrams for our information lattice, we just need to check that our information lattice satisfies the distributive property. If it doesn't, there is no hope that we will draw some Venn diagrams. If it does, we don't know how to draw it, but we know that it's possible. Now, let's see with three random variables, right? That was the problem. The synergy case was what's failing. There is a theorem that says that every finite lattice can be embedded in a finite partition lattice. Now, not every lattice is distributive, okay? So these guys are saying that some sublattices of partition lattices, so like our information lattices, will not be distributive, okay? So there is at least one sublattice of a partition lattice that will be bad for us. All right, there's at least one, but how bad is this? For example, we know that for two random variables, we were perfectly able to draw a set theoretical picture, right? What about three? Well, now take this partition. X is a binary like random variable, so to say. We partition into these two regions. Y, the same, independently. And now, as Z, we take somehow, the XOR gate. So Z has this, and these are the same region, and these are a different region, okay? So this is kind of the synergy example of before. Now, you see that if you take any two of them, they make some kind of a cross, right? So any two of them define the same joint partition, which is simply partition into four regions. With intersection, it's more subtle, but actually they also all have the same, they also have the same meat, because you see X and Y actually have no common boundaries, but also X and Z, so this is not really a common boundary between X and Z. Because for example, you see that X distinguishes between left and right, and Z does not, all right? So actually, it's clearer if you imagine this in three dimensions. Sorry, because I could not draw this, but so these three partitions are really, like, imagine the three perpendicular planes that cut this picture in half. So you see that they have no common boundaries, right? And so the lattice of information of this structure is this one here, which is called M3. Now, M3 is famous for having, well, some properties. It's the simplest lattice that already behaves badly. Let's see if it's distributive. So if this is equal to this. Now we do the join of Y and Z. So the join of these two elements is the top. And now we have to do the meet with X, which is X, right? On the right, we have to do first the meet of these two elements, which is the bottom. And of course, it's the same if we do with this and this one. So we get bottom, join bottom, which is, of course, the bottom. So this is not equal to this. So this does not have the distributive property. So this lattice is not a lattice of sets. And you cannot represent this with Venn diagrams in a faithful way. What does this say? This says that no matter what, if you take the union of the intersection of the complement of 1,000 or 1,000,000 sets, as long as it's a finite number, you will not be able to represent the partition lattice, the information lattice of this random variable. Just will not work, because it will not be distributed. So in this case, this example of synergy shows us that there's no hope that we can draw Venn diagrams to represent Shannon inequalities. So to conclude, or to summarize, information of N observables forms naturally a lattice. So this partial order that has to do with partitions of the outcome space. All right, so it's being able to distinguish. Entropy comes up naturally as a monotone function on this lattice from this large numbers limit of these permutations. So monotone means that it will satisfy some inequalities that respect the order of the lattice where we started from. Now, this information lattice is not distributive for n larger than 2, so it's not representable with Venn diagrams. And so this Shannon type inequalities cannot be represented faithfully by drawing sets if we have more than 2 random variables. Now, by faithfully, let me clear, because I don't want to say something inappropriate. We have 3 things here: information lattice, the Shannon inequalities, and Venn diagrams. All right? Now, there is a map from here to here. So to say, the information lattice encodes somehow Shannon inequalities. So if you want, kind of causes the Shannon inequalities in some way. Or you can see Shannon inequalities as some kind of arising from this lattice structure. And we've proven that there is no way that you can get from the information lattice to a faithful representation in terms of Venn diagrams. Now, I am not saying that you cannot go directly from here to here. I'm not saying anything about this arrow. But of course, if you view entropy really as something having to do with this distinction, partition, and permutation things, which in my view is pretty natural, also not just for information theory, but also for thermodynamics, then if you find an arrow from here to here, it will not really respect this kind of picture, right? So our standard tool for analyzing interactions are not adequate if the interactions have high order. We have to switch to something more general. For example, the lattice itself, which is, I mean, more general than sets. Now, where do we go from here? Well, it's really tempting to try to answer this question. If this lattice is exactly what, so to say, causes synergy or what represents a synergy, right? So we use this as a counterexample, but is this always the case? So that when we have synergy, then there's this lattice involved? Or more generally, is synergy actually something that has to do with non-distributive properties in general, so not just in this example? This is tempting because, well, what we did suggests this, but of course to prove this is a lot more subtle than that. That's actually what we are trying to do in these days, Tobias and I. So we don't know this actually, but a counterexample is enough to show that, set theoretical pictures are not enough to do this analysis. To say it in one sentence, basically, not only is the whole not just the sum of its parts, but also the parts are not subsets of the whole in any way. Well, thanks for your attention. Any questions? Yep.
Is there a way of understanding the conditional entropies in the lattice framework? So
yes.
Back when you presented
yes.
just the lattice of
yes, good question.
X,
actually,
y, the union, the medium join.
Yes, there is. Actually, this is a good question. This complicates things a little. That's why I didn't talk about it. But you can do it. So, if instead of taking a lattice that's closed with respect to union intersections, you also close with respect to complements, okay?
Good.
So here, that's actually the easiest thing to do, because if you know about measure theory, that's exactly a finite subsigma algebra. So in that case, then conditional entropy, for example, would be encoded by the complement, so x minus y. So this is kind of like as we drew it here, so to say, if you remember. So conditional scanning code, so to say, complements.
So this in your lattice would be x meet y bar, like let's say bar denotes complement. So we add an x bar and a y bar at the same level as x and y. And
yes.
X meet y bar is.
Yeah, well, yes. So basically it would look like, where do I go here? It would look like this, right? So we have x and y. Then we have x minus y, which is the red region. And we have y minus x, which is the blue region. And all these three are disjoint. So their common intersection is the empty set. Now, of course, we can form the union. So here we get x. Here we get y. Right? So these are these two. And, well, these are disjoint, so that means then we have a common union, so x union y, for all these three. Right? No. There is also, of course, the union of these two sides, the union of these two colored elements. And this way we get what's called a Boolean lattice. So it's a little more than a distributive lattice. And you see that our lattice that we drew before, where is that? This one here, it's a sub-lattice of this one. It's just this part. So if we allow all the complements, we get a larger lattice, which will still be distributed. And actually, you can do the whole thing.
So I haven't quite understood yet. I would have expected that the same level x and y, rather than having one additional point, you would have had two, namely the complement of x as one point and the complement of y as another point. Is that what those guys are? Yeah.
Yes. This is the complement of y, and this is the complement of x. You can write it in the same way.
If our sets are like this, then you see that the complement of y,
yes,
is the same as x minus y.
Sorry, I can't see forward.
I didn't try to draw it.
If you come to the sideboard, it'll be easier to see.
Yeah, sure. So. You see that?
Yeah.
This is the complement of y?
No, I would say the complement of y is like if you draw the whole box, it's everything outside of y.
Oh, yeah, okay, sure. In this case, we are assuming that there are no additional random variables. So actually, the union of the two is equal to zero. Okay.
But you assume there's a distinction between u and x union y. So I would have thought as y bar would be u minus y.
Sure. So that would mean that there's additional information here. There's an additional step. This is a general case. Okay, sure. In that case, we would have some other stuff here.
Right. So I'm thinking that take the lattice where you have an x, a y, x complement, y complement. Then you've got all the possible intersections of those guys.
Yes.
So x meet y bar.
Yes.
So the conditional entropy x given y,
yeah,
that's x meet y bar, or what is that?
The conditional entropy, of x given y.
X given y, yeah.
This corresponds to x minus y. So not this, just this is the conditional.
So that is x meet y bar.
X meets y bar. Yes.
Y complement.
Yes.
Okay. So you also have, like, if we drew the lattice that I'm talking about, you'd have an extra element above the bottom, which would be x bar meets y bar, which would be everything outside.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah. Circles.
Yeah.
So what's the entropic quantity associated with that? I guess it's just.
That's the information of the whole minus information of the two random variables that we have. So we have some kind of depends. So if we just have two random variables, and we don't have more, that includes no information.
Probably.
Of course, if we look at the partition lattice of our sample space, so in this case, there would be some, the distinction, like the discrete partition, and so how would that be? We get a huge term, which would be the difference in entropy between distinguishing all the points and the distinction of our random variable. I don't know if that is the difference in entropy between a uniform distribution and our distribution, or between that distribution and the alpha. We have to do the math. Anyway, it encodes the total information minus the one half given by our two random variables.
Sure.
Which is all the species.
So, okay, I think I understand now the sort of mapping of all entropic quantities to. The lattice theoretic description. So now I'm curious whether there's a notion of complementation in the lattice of partitions.
Well,
and if so, because what I'm aiming at is trying to make sense of something like I x colon y given z. Right? That doesn't appear anywhere your presentation. And so the thing that we were talking about previously, I x colon y colon z, which is defined as this difference, it would be nice if you had this broader lattice, which include notions of conditionals.
Maybe
I can see why that doesn't make sense.
Well, the thing is, sure, yeah, but that doesn't make sense, right? So The problem is that if we allow complements,
yes,
our lattice is booleans, so it has to satisfy the distributive problem. So if the lattice is not distributive, we cannot define complements on it. So take where do I go here?
But hang on, I mean that
take this lattice together, one that we did with synergy,
right?
And so what is the complement should satisfy? For example, that x.
The lattice of projectors. Hmm? You thought it was a complemented lattice, even though it's not.
No, wait. This is the wrong example. Exactly. No, we should pick like something like this one, for example. Does n five?
It might be that not every lattice that fails distributivity admits of a complement, but I don't think it's true that every lattice that's complemented must be distributed, because you know the lattice that I'm familiar with, which is just the lattice of projectors of Hilbert space under subspace inclusion, clearly, if I interpret join and meet as linear span and intersection, I have complements, but I don't have distributivity. So I know there exist such lattices.
No, okay.
So there's an option for introducing complementation.
So yes. We could use
it might not be clear what that notion would be in terms of your partitions.
No, it's true. In that case, I don't know. Actually, I was not thinking of this, I have to say. So I was thinking of this in terms of the Stigma algebra.
Uh-huh.
So I was assuming that complementation came naturally in information theory just if we had distributivity. So since we don't have distributivity, I didn't look even at complementation. But yeah, this is interesting, actually. I have to say, I don't know. So I would expect that, yes, you could get conditioning with the complements. This would make sense. Of course, it wouldn't be complements of sets. So it would be a Boolean lattice. I can check here. This is an interesting question here. If the way it's constructed, it comes up also with complements given condition.
So maybe we can sort it out. You've already defined the notion of meet and join in your partition lattice.
Yeah.
And so the complement then should be defined. It's, you know, so if you take this partition X and you ask, what partition is such that were I to join it to X would give me the kind of full partition, where every point is its own cell, and if you meet it with X, gives you the trivial partition.
Yes.
So I guess it's
it's
every line that's not already in the set of lines that X.
So yes, yeah, that makes sense. So the problem is there might be some problem with the size of that.
That will be far from unique. Also,
well, kind of non-unique.
You have many different choices for that complement. Well, taking a complement should be some kind of algebraic operation that takes you there, and then you go back and you apply it twice.
Uh-huh.
Hmm. But yeah.
But maybe you could find a canonical example of that, and then define a complementation method.
Hmm.
So where I was going with all this is that at the end of the day, if you had, for example, a notion of what I, x colon y given z is in this lattice theoretic language, then maybe you could show that the mutual x colon y is the point for the last question of that, and the x colon y given z point are not ordered relative to one another. So there's no reason to think that there's a quantity such that the difference of the two is going to be positive.
Yeah, right? Sure.
Because they're just not above one another in the lattice.
Yeah, actually.
So that would sort of give a lattice theoretic interpretation of the thing you started your talk with.
Yeah, so see, that's the idea, Mara. So that's the idea that if we want to put these in a lattice, of course they would have to be uncompared.
Right.
Because
but currently
that's the inequality scales.
Yeah.
So sure, so if we ever were to include this in a lattice, or in this case, complements, so conditioning that, yeah, of course, there would be two points that cannot be compared.
Right.
And
so it'd be nice if your lattice included a point corresponding to x mutual y conditioned on z.
Yeah, could do it. Which should, there's some some issue with the size of the partition, because we don't want to partition the sample space, we want to partition the outcome space. And so we, I guess the complement would give us...
Alternatively, one could try to assign entropy to the arrows of that lattice. And that would capture real conditional entropy, maybe?
Yeah, that's, I mean, to get to just get the number of the conditional entropy, we can assign a quantity to these arrows. And to make the numbers, it would be, so if these are quotients, so quotient subgroups that get larger, so that means subgroups get smaller. So subgroups that get smaller than the co-kernel of this map, the inclusion of subgroups, give us a group, and its cardinality would be equal to the conditional.
So then
but of course that would not feed into the left, it would just be the average.
We could still try to read off the monotonicity properties from
that. Yes, of course. Yeah, that would satisfy anyway the rights and properties. The ones with conditions, so for example, this one. So actually the lattice structure gives all the Shannon inequalities, also the ones that involve conditioning, because for example conditional entropy is equal to the drive entropy minus n plus. So
you mean what?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So actually these are comes from the
I didn't quite follow how monotonicity follows if you associate entropies with the arrows. So what's the scheme if one arrow is above another arrow?
Yeah, so
in the lattice?
So these have to do with, let's start with subgroups, the Caesar subquotients. Let's just be careful of the order. And, anyway, the idea is that if we increase, if we have a subgroup, so included in another subgroup, including your G, okay?
Yeah.
That in particular, this is included in your G. And the co-kernel of this inclusion has some cardinality. The co-kernel of this inclusion has some cardinality. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And these satisfy some, there's a bound, I don't remember the formula exactly between the co-kernel of this one and the co-kernel of this one somehow. They relate to these. So, I don't remember exactly how it works, but...
So maybe what happens is that the number on an arrow increases as you compose it with another arrow, or does not decrease?
Yes, so that's it.
Can you take, what do you mean by composition arrows? Like if I have two arrows, then I can think of sort of one arrow, which is the...
Yeah, yeah. These are kind of the generating
arrows. So you would not only associate entropies with each arrow, but also kind of paths.
These are
yes,
the generating
this
arrows.
Is, this is one path.
I see. And then you'd say, okay, well, if the entropy of a path is greater than or equal to the sum of the entropies of all the arrows in that path.
Yes.
That would be the idea.
Something like that. So I don't remember which way the inequality goes, but yeah.
That's
And actually, that's, I mean, we didn't use any categorativeness talk specifically because, well, it's abstract, but the idea that entropy constructed this way is actually factorial. So it's even more, as I mean, it's even better defined if one thinks of entropy of an arrow. And so, yeah, so you get this kind of thing that have an inequality for objects, so to say, which is. Or then the marginals and those go for one time. So by the TVT entropy, and also have one for the arrows. This quantity is positive, so strong subadditivity is the same thing.
May I interpret the main result as sort of a no-go result for any GPT that you can't draw like drop-in diagrams to explain that.
Sorry, can you just keep coming to that?
May I interpret the main result as sort of a no-go result, saying that if you take any GPT, like any state space, and you have like more than two random variables, then I can't use Venn diagrams to express the information content?
I would say yes, but I have to be like, no, what GPT is.
Oh, like a general probabilistic theory. Like you're just considering like an arbitrary like universe and then like points distributed inside. I actually thought at one point that you might like say, okay, what if the points inside are like sort of, what if it's like Rob was talking about, like a non-distributed or fourth modular lattice like quantum theory or something like that, but he sort of left a general sense, so that's why I thought maybe it's applicable to all different problems.
I have to say I don't know. I mean, they're not.
The answer is no, because this is a result really about classical probability theory. So from the very beginning, you know, to say that the joint entropy is larger than the entropy of the marginal, I mean, you've already excluded quantum theory. Quantum theory, a bipartite state can be pure, where marginal can be impure. So these inequalities won't hold for but Neumann entropy and quantum states.
Now this here, everything is classical, so
yeah.
The whole thing cannot be done. At least not in this way.
Okay.
But that is a good question, which is there's a sort of quantum analog of a lot of these inequalities. Some of them fail, but there are some inequalities that are preserved in the quantum case.
Sure.
Do you imagine that there could be a lattice theoretic treatment that gives you the quantum inequalities?
I actually don't know. I'm not familiar enough with quantum information theory. I don't know. I cannot answer the question. Maybe Tobias knows, but
he wants to know off the top of my head.
So, well, of course, one should take care of commutativity of these observables, but I actually don't know.
Probably you could start with the, instead of a lattice of partitions, a lattice of quantum POVMs. Right?
Sure.
So you have sort of more incompatibility, sort of more breadth in the partial
but
order.
What corresponds to the partitions,
well,
I guess, should be commutative sub-algebras if you're algebraically sorted. These are kind of like contexts. Partition is like the maximally fine grained measurement that
your partitions weren't necessarily maximally fine grained.
No, sorry, I'm expressing myself, but a partition is the kind of tells you the maximal amount of information that you can gather from the measurement. So the quantum case would translate into a commutative sub-algebra.
Oh, you're saying like not POVMs but objective measurements?
No, not necessarily. But
no.
Yeah, okay. Yes, yeah, I guess in a sense, yes.
Yeah, because you didn't talk at all about measurements that were probabilistic, where the outcome was probabilistic given where you are in the sample space. So the analog of the quantum case would be to focus just on the projective measurements. It's not on the POVM.
But it doesn't matter what labels you assign to the outcome, so
and it doesn't matter, so it's...
So it's about commutative sub-algebras.
Sure, I think that's equivalent to saying it's a kind of resolution of identity. That's the key thing. A resolution of identity defines a commutative sub-algebra, the full algebra. The same thing. So yeah, you have a partial order of those under the ordering induced by coarse graining, where you sum up the projectors in that resolution of identity. And then in place of your automorphism group, so you have a particular quantum state, which could have no support in some of those projectors, just like your distributions could have no points in some regions. And so you'd have a kind of some sort of automorphism group, which would now be a subgroup of the unitaries,
yeah,
which keeps you sort of in the same same probability assignment to these resolutions of unity. So I suspect all that stuff would work.
I guess instead of multinomial getting across man.
Sorry?
Guess instead of multinomial getting across man.
I still didn't hear that.
Instead of a multinomial,
yeah,
get across man.
You get a Grassmannian?
Yeah.
You mean the point where you have the quotient of the cardinalities?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, because you could again say, well, it's not a... You would still have a group of transformations, which would now be just a subgroup of the unitaries. Still try to assign a measure to those guys and a measure to the quotient space. It just wouldn't be. These wouldn't be integers anymore.
Yeah, I see. Actually, I don't know how it works in the continuous case. So yeah, I don't know.
In any case, it seems like a lot of the steps of what you're doing could be taken over to the quantum case. Maybe there'll be an obstacle at some point. But.
Well, actually, I mean, again, the way I presented here is quite practical with sets and partitions, but the way we kind of did it is more with capillaries and functors. So I guess that way it's even closer to our extension to the quantum case, because it's more abstract. But of course, there are lots of things to get here about that case. Well, how about that?
Yeah. Well, if the objective is sort of coming up with an abstract framework that allows you to say very generic things about information theory, taking our second best example of an information theory, quantum information theory, and showing that your abstract framework can handle that too is a great way of proving that you've captured the core of this.
Yes. This is mostly a negative thought, so I've proven that we cannot do something in a possible case. I couldn't say the same thing about a quantum case. I mean, of course we cannot do it in the quantum case with sets. But yeah, well, the way we look at this, that's really, they're probably analyzes the quantum case in a similar way. It's actually to be very interesting to do.
Okay, let's thank the speaker.